Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dina Metzger. She's a writer and feminist and ecological thinker. She's published over 19 books and has been teaching writing for over 50 years. La Negra y Blanca won the Oakland Penn Literature Award. Her penultimate novel, A Rain of Nightbirds, focuses on two climatologists, one native, who confronts what they know and what they learn from the land and the cosmos. An earlier novel, The Other Hand, is an epistolary novel addressed to Cardinal Lustiger by the protagonist, a cosmologist who states that the Holocaust and the bomb are the two Coens of the 20th century. In La Vieja, A Journal of Fire, which is her latest novel, La Vieja takes up residence in a fire lookout in the Sierras, watching for fires and crossing the borders between time and space, human and animal. She originated the genre, the literature of restoration. Promotes spirit-based, earth-based writing free of the seeds of extinction and climate collapse. She lives at the end of the road in the Santa Monica Mountains with coyote, bobcat, mountain lion, squirrel, owl, raven, and more on the land she and the community have designated as a sanctuary for all beings, and regularly meets with African elephants in the wild. Her website is Dina, D-E-E-N-A, Metzger, M-E-T-Z-G-E-R, .net. So first off, thanks for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
My great pleasure being here and speaking with you.
So before we get to anything serious, when I was reading about the animals on the land there, I always say coyote. And are you one of the people who says coyote?
I am one of those who says coyote, yes.
Yeah, I think it's a Colorado, New Mexico thing. I grew up in Colorado, and I mainly heard coyote until I got into the big wide world.
Yeah, I think it's because Topanga's closer to Mexico.
Makes perfect sense.
Right.
Okay, so go ahead. Go ahead.
If I was speaking Spanish, I would say estamos con los coyotes. And so coyote is closer to coyotes.
Of course, at this point, the county I live in Northern California is spelled D-E-L space N-O-R-T-E, and everybody pronounces it Del Norte. So
there you go, Del Norte.
There you go. So we are as American as can be in terms of, or USian as can be in terms of speaking. Okay, anyway, so you have a new project that I would love to hear about.
So the project is Literature of Restoration. Trying to imagine or having seen evidence of writing that if it entered the world and entered our language, might change the way we are. Because literature restoration is an attempt to infuse language and literature with the presence of the natural world. It's not about the natural world so much as it is infused with the natural world, with spirit, with kindness, with truth, with the life force. And it's literature that does not see conflict as so much of contemporary fiction does, as at the core. It looks at what brings things together rather than what sets them apart. So I've been thinking about literature of restoration probably about 20 years. And I've been teaching it for, I don't know, maybe the same amount of time. And now we felt that we wanted to create a website where people could read this work. But we think about it more than reading this work, kind of think of the website as a place to visit, as a gathering place. It's a place to be inspired. And in the welcome letter, we say, we're deeply pleased for the opportunity to introduce literature of restoration and to introduce you to it. As a literature emerges from culture, which in turn is shaped by literature, we're hoping that over time, a new literature will emerge, not wedded to death and violence, but from which we might say, long life for the future of all beings, the natural world and earth. We think of this site as a community gathering in conversation around a central fire in the woods, with the owls hooting to each other, the wolves howling to the moon while gathering the pack, the crickets chanting while tuning the world, our informants and characters in the stories told, as well as companions in the circle. We come together, all of us, to share stories, the oldest form of telling, in old, old, and also very new ways. So this website is launching on April 22nd. It'll be live on April 22nd, which is Earth Day, and the website link is simply literatureofrestoration.org. And we're very excited about it.
So let's get really basic here. And I mean, I love the language of what you said. And well, I'm just going to throw a couple things out. One of them is that I remember reading many years ago, decades ago, that in most Western literature, the landscape is the stage upon which the drama is set, as opposed to one of the characters. And that always struck me, and I've attempted in my books to make the land one of the characters. And I don't even know what I mean by that. So first off, do you agree that that's part of this literature of restoration? And second, how would that manifest, say, in your own writing? If you're talking to a young writer who says, wow, this is really cool, but I don't have actually any idea what you're talking about, what sort of exercises would you give them to help them to see the landscape as a character in a way that isn't, I mean, it also has to be good, you know? It's like, how are you going to do it and not be like either preachy or maudlin or just boring or something? How do you make it work? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, and so many questions. Let me go back to the first one. The idea that the language is a stage, it's a prop, it gives you a few interesting things, is not the same. Not the language, but that the natural world is just a prop or a stage, but that the beings of the natural world or the natural world itself are the characters. Or are some of the characters. It's something like when a native person introduces herself or himself or themselves, they say they're from this land. And they mean that they have been shaped by this land, that is as important to them as who their parents are. And their parents have also been shaped by this land if they are completely indigenous. And very often a native person will say something like, I am bear, or I am coyote, or I come from the bear people. They mean that they are in that depth of relationship with the other beings. And you once knew such a language. So we'll go there and then we'll come back to the questions you're asking me, because this morning I looked again at a language older than words and I couldn't find my book. So I went on to audio and I heard these words that I'd like you to read, in which you knew exactly, you were telling exactly what we're talking about here.
So the place you reference is actually the first paragraph of the book. There is a language older by far and deeper than words. It's the language of bodies, of body on body, wind on snow, rain on trees, wave on stone. It's the language of dream, gesture, symbol, memory. We've forgotten this language. We do not even remember that it exists.
So I think it is somewhere in Endgame that you say something like, you know, the trees speak, they have feelings, or they have a bad day. I think the line was, you said, I think the trees can say that they have a bad day. So to understand the vitality, the sentience, the intelligence, the presence of all the beings is essential. And it seems to me it's essential to have it in language and in literature. So what would I say to that young man who says, I don't know what you're talking about? So, of course, the first thing I would say is go outside and spend a lot of time outside and listen and open yourself up. And, you know, again, the book that I have in my lap, The Myth of Human Supremacy, we would ask him to give up the myth of human supremacy. So if he can be outside and feel his peerage with the other beings, that's a beginning. And then how does that enter literature? Well, there are quite a few, I don't know how many pieces that we've posted on literature of restoration. It's not a website that is about it so much as it is a website in which these pieces exist. And I have for my own writing a section, well, two sections actually, and one is from A Rain of Nightbirds, where that native climatologist goes to the mountain and he speaks to the mountain in the old way. Another, there's a section in La Vieja where the bear that's of the territory where La Vieja is, she's on his land. And there's another couple, Leonie and Lucas, and they are also in the Sierras, and they are also on the bear's land. And at one point, the bear comes, and the bear needs to check out Lucas. He trusts Leonie because she's a dreamer, and because he knows, because he is a sentient, intelligent being who knows these things. He knows that she dreams bears. That is, they have been together in the dream life. You see what's happening here, Derek. I'm talking about the real world, and the real world in which animals and humans communicate, in which dreams are real, in which the spirits exist, and which the literature is comfortable speaking of this, rendering it. in order to write literature of restoration, we have to open ourselves up to what the dominant culture has prevented us from knowing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I like it a lot, and I have a slightly different direction to go that I hope will make sense if you're done talking about that. If you have more to say about that, then keep going, because this is going to change the subject.
Well, I'm just thinking about another piece in my writing, because you had asked that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you introduced me, you spoke about my relationship with elephants. And I was with a herd of elephants in 2017. And it's the herd at Tula Tula in South Africa. That was started by what's called an elephant whisperer, Lawrence Anthony. He had a preserve and he brought a herd of elephants there because otherwise they were going to be killed. And one of the elephants was named Frankie. And she and I had quite an interesting connection in reality, in which she spoke to me very clearly about how difficult it was to be a matriarch of elephants in an enclosed place that was suffering a drought. And she couldn't take her people to water. And she was not living any longer in the area that she knew very well, that was sort of ingrained in her DNA. And she was in a small area that she had learned, which was her responsibility, but they were out of water. So I had this connect, this heartbreaking connection with her. And then at one point, she came, shall we say, in a dream, or she came as a spirit. I felt her, saw her in my room, and she spoke to me about a true attack, a kind of massacre of some baby rhinos that had been rescued and then attacked for their non-existent tusks, because the tusks had been removed to protect them, but it didn't work. At any rate, it is this sense of the reality of spirit, which I think we have to open ourselves up to again, and the intelligence of the natural world, that is essential for us to know. And if we live in that world, and if we don't live in a world of conflict, but in a world of relationship and interconnection, and we write about that all the time, and that's the ground, not the stage, but that's the ground that we render, then maybe the culture could change. I yield to you.
I'm thinking about I'm thinking a couple things. One is just how extraordinary wild nature is. And I just read the other day that mountain lions, you could almost call it garden for their prey, by which I mean that mountain lions will kill at certain places, and they don't actually eat most of the meat. They eat some of it, but a lot of it's taken by a lot of other animals, big and small. And it ends up that the carcasses that they end up leaving behind fertilize the soil such that it makes the proper plants that are preferred by their prey species. And it's just magnificent how everything works together. I can never get over that. So it's one thing. And then another thing I just want to mention, because I read it just yesterday and it broke my heart. And it's again, what we are cost by not living with wild nature, but instead against it. And the article I read yesterday said that in 1847, 1852, 1857, there were these huge waves of squirrels making massive migrations. They were so big, they would swim across the Ohio in 1819, the Niagara in 1866, the Mississippi 1881. And sometimes it would take a month for these squirrels to pass, and there might be a density of 30,000 squirrels per square mile. So the migration could have included, a one migration could have included more than 40 million squirrels.
Oh my God.
I know, this is like the flocks of passenger pigeons. And nobody, this was in the Washington Post, by the way, so you can find it pretty easily. Anyway, the point is that, you and I will never see those great flocks of passenger pigeons, and the stories of them are so extraordinary that they're almost unbelievable. And it was, I have a new one today with this squirrels. Or I remember reading early accounts of San Francisco Bay that the European explorers said that the bay looked like it was, quote, paved with sea lions. There were so many. And it's just one of the things that I am trying to do with all these different interviews is, oh, one more thing. This has to do with squirrels, and it has to do with what I'm getting at, is that I interviewed David Matson a couple weeks ago about grizzly bears, and I said at some point, give me some little factlet about grizzly bears. It's going to amaze and astound us all. And he said that squirrels will hide certain sorts of nuts, white bark pine nuts. And he said one of the ways when you're tracking grizzly bears in the wild, if you're trying to find them, one of the things you can do is just stop and listen for angry squirrels, because the grizzly bears will quite often steal these caches of nuts. And the squirrels, of course, being tiny, can't do anything but stamp their little feet and yell. And so he said that happens often enough that you can sometimes track grizzly bears that way. And my point is just, I don't know how anybody could not just fall in love with wild nature just by being outside. And it doesn't matter where you are, there are going to be those dramas and those stories that you can see. You may not see a grizzly bear, you won't see a grizzly bear in Southern California, but you will see a coyote slash coyote, and then you'll see the interactions between that and others. It's just, anyway, I'm sorry. I just wanted to go on about the magnificence of nature for a moment.
Derek, I'm going to play with that story of the squirrel, the angry squirrel. I'm going to tell the story this way. There is a natural relationship between the squirrel and the mountain lion, not unlike the relationship between the wolf and ravens, where the ravens find the prey and they open the body, and the wolves, and they share the food. So let's have another mind. Let's have a non-Western mind. There's a relationship between the squirrel and the mountain lion, and the squirrel gets the nuts. Now we know that squirrels get far more nuts than they need. Many of those nuts are designed to grow and create trees, and some of them could be for the mountain lion. And what we call anger, because that's our go-to, how about a celebrity dance? How about they dance by pounding on the earth and making sound, and they're celebrating? Oh, mountain lion found it. Good. Okay.
That works.
Right? It's a different mind. It doesn't go to anger. And that's what happens in English. And that, and English is such a combative language. And so all our reflexes are violent. I'm hoping that someday, down to a cellular consciousness, we will change from our violence. And it's not everywhere. It isn't in all languages. It is definitely in the dominant languages and imperial languages. It's not necessarily in native languages, which are much more connective.
So thank you for all that. And there's one question that when I asked, what would you say to a young writer, you told the writer to go outside, and then what would you tell them if they spent time outside and they saw some experiences? I think you just manifested this with the story about the squirrel, but can you tell them what you would suggest about their writing too? How can there are some writers who listen to this, and how can they, like, several years ago I read 13 Moons by Charles Frazier, which is a love story between a man and a woman, which I didn't find so interesting. But what I loved about that book is that somehow or another, he really manifested a love story between the protagonist and the land, which was North Carolina, 1820 to 1900. And so what tips would you give writers to help write love stories between that include the landscape and a character? I'm asking you to get crafty here, to the craft of writing. You know, right. how does one imbue one's writing and make clear to the reader that you're having not only a love story between two humans, say if we take Charles Frazier's example, but like, how did, I know you probably haven't read Charles Frazier's book, but how did he do it? How would you do that, where you're having a love story between a character and the land?
Well, the first thing I would say, Derek, is have courage. Have courage to put into your writing everything you know and believe, and to avoid as best as you can all those inhibitions to say, oh, we don't talk about that. Oh, that's not true. Oh, no, you didn't dream that. No, you didn't hear that when you were a kid. No, you did not hear that tree speak to you. So the first thing is write the truth. And mostly the truth these days in this culture is what the children know when they come in, you know, before they're completely socialized, before someone says, just don't lie there daydreaming. And then I would say, write your body. What does your body know? So much of this, you know, when I teach this, so much is received when I simply say, what did you know that you know you knew? Write what other people told you you didn't know, but you know it. Write your intuitions. Write your sensations. Write your instincts. Write your feelings. Write your heart. What do you love? And Dare to write what you love. Dare to write awe. You know, like what surprises you? What just popped into my mind was one moment when I was here on the land. I was in the yurt. I came out of the yurt and I looked, oh, probably about 40 feet away. And there was a mountain lion. And I looked at him. Well, I couldn't swear it was a him, but he felt like a him. He stopped and I stopped. And the word that came up in my mind was, "Hello, neighbor." And I'm remembering it now. I'm remembering a moment of no fear, but recognition. He was going to go his way. He was not going to attack me. I was not even thinking that he would attack me. And that's another thing to tell the young man. What if you go outside with your notebook, of course, and you imagine that you are safe? And you are safe because the natural world is benevolent. And of course, everybody has to eat, and so do we. But for the most part, the natural world is not aggressive. The natural world is benevolent, interconnected, and as you put it, there was that mountain lion going out and fertilizing the land so all the plants could grow. And I thought about what I just read in one of your books, I don't know where, about you were just really excited about the whales, right, that eat the squid that are all the way at the bottom of the ocean, and they have a lot of iron. And then the whales go to the top and they do what they do, and they defecate and they enrich the ocean bed with the iron that the squid need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, that's it. Interconnection, relationship, let's stop being afraid.
And I think that's so important. You know, I've mentioned before that I see bears every day. In fact, I saw a bear 5 minutes before we got on the the call. And everybody's like, "Aren't you afraid?" And it's like, no. And in fact, you know, relatives of these bears have been killed by humans, and none of these bears have killed any of my humans. I mean, killed any of my relatives. I was watching a movie the other night, and it was so stupid. There's this guy out in the wilderness, and for no reason at all, wolves come up to where he's got a little campfire, and he has to grab a flaming piece of wood out of the campfire and hold them off. And it's like, you've never actually seen a wolf, have you? And they're just, you know, I walk outside every day and there's bears around, and it's they're neighbors, and we respect each other and respect each other's space, but I'm not scared. The only time I've ever been scared walking on this land is frankly when I saw some strange humans.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think, I don't think we've ever talked about this, but I want to write an essay someday about how much I can't stand most nature programs, because as soon as they show a lion, the lion is killing something, right, or a spider even. And I read the other day that some spiders can live like months without eating. They spend most of their time hanging out doing spider things, whatever that means. And we have this idea that, you know, even for a prey animal, they, you know, the deer might live a couple years before it gets killed. I mean, most of its time is not spent in mortal terror. Most of its time is just spent eating or hanging out or sleeping.
When I was in Africa, I watched a lion walk through a herd of impala. The lion was not hungry, and the impala were just fine. That's ex exactly what you're telling. Our insistence on the eros of violence. We can't imagine showing an animal, a wild animal, without showing their violence, because their violence is so exciting. Well, actually, that's not how the animals are.
One of my favorite memories ever of a bear is I was wandering through the forest and I was somehow being quiet. You know, it's very hard to be quiet in a forest because there's all these, you step on all these branches, but for whatever reason, I was quiet and the wind was blowing into my face. And I come over this little rise and I see this bear about on the other side of a bole. It was maybe, I don't know, 20 yards away. And he didn't see me and he didn't smell me because his wind's blowing my direction. And I just stood there and all he was doing was sitting, staring into the distance, thinking, you know, who knows what. It was just, that was one of my favorite memories ever because he didn't see me. So there was no, you know, he wasn't, he was simply being a bear. And what that consisted of is, basically the same as if I would have come across a human sitting on a log, just sort of looking into the distance and noticing how beautiful the forest is. And it was just, he just sat there for, I stood there watching him and he sat there watching something else in the forest for several minutes. It was just a delight. And he wasn't like, you know, growling at anybody. He was just hanging out, you know, probably thinking about, I don't know how, probably dreaming or something. I don't know what he was doing. And that's another thing that's really important is we have these interactions, but it's also really important to recognize that these are, we have connections to them, which is really important. And at the same time, that's not a human in a bear suit. That's a bear whose world is completely different because, you know, they smell. That their sense of smell is 30 times or 1,000 times stronger, I mean, some huge amount stronger than ours. And so they're not just little, you know, humans in snake suits. They are entirely different beings whose lives are just as magnificent as our own. And also, and we have connections. I don't want to say we don't, but they are also, you know, completely incomprehensible to us. But like all these you know, plants giving off the chemical messages that are then smelled by insects, you know, we can't know what that's like, and we just have to respect it.
You know, I know that you have a connection with Gay Bradshaw, and so you must know of her relationship with Charlie Russell, and who was a, he really understood the grizzly and had an incredible relationship with grizzlies. And he befriended them. He raised these orphaned grizzlies in the wild, and it started out where he was in the Kamchatka province in Siberia, and he met, I'm going to say, he met this female grizzly, and she watched him and she began to trust him. And then she left her cubs with him. He became the nanny. Well, what's remarkable about that is that he could understand her language well enough to understand that he was being not asked quite. He was required to take care of these cubs. And while she went off to get food and to rest and do whatever she wanted to do. And I think that when we say that the animals are so dangerous and so fierce and so aggressive, that's just projection. That's just us. And we don't know who they are. We have no idea who they are and what they're thinking. And I think that is the challenge of this time. Can we set our own minds aside and just see, try to understand the presence of these extraordinary beings?
And I think it's, thank you for that. And I think it's really important to also be clear that one can have these interactions and relationships no matter where you are. That even if you're in the middle of a big city, there are still wild animals who live there.
Oh, yes. There are squirrels and there are pigeons and forgive me, there are mice, there are rats, there are all kinds of beings. And increasingly, there are coyotes. And so instead of being horrified that there are coyotes, how about admiring their fortitude of being able to survive in such a difficult environment, their intelligence, their adaptability.
Another thing I love about nature is that nothing goes to waste. I really enjoy the processes. I really enjoy watching the processes of, you know, a limb falls to the ground and then moss starts to grow on it or fungi grow through it. And I love watching that branch fall apart over years. And everybody, or just this morning, I was out there and there were some banana slugs eating some dog poop. And, you know, it's like there are cleanup crews everywhere. And the coyotes, when we think of this, that, you know, a lot of these in cities, you know, a lot of these animals basically subsist on trash, on human throwaway. And I love that in nature there is no trash.
Right. Even though we continuously try to create things they can't digest.
Well, yeah, that's a huge problem, all the plastics and all that. So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and let's go back to what do you hope on a small scale and then a larger social scale, what do you hope for from the first off, how do people find it? It's literatureofrestoration.org, literatureofrestoration.org. And what are you hoping on both a small scale, individual scale, and a larger social scale that will happen because of this?
I'm hoping that people, readers and writers, will come to the site. They will see that there's a lot of reading material so they can come again and again. You know, you're flying on a plane and you're bored and the movies are not interesting. Well, okay, so go on the site and read some wonderful material and be inspired. You know, just in the way that we're speaking now, begin to see that the world is far more complex and interesting and interconnected than you may have known, and be encouraged to write in these deep ways. And seek out that literature and You know, I am absolutely sure that we have not found all the examples of literature of restoration that exists. So to seek those out and to have that way of writing, it's not the only way, it's not the only subject, but that it could become a substantial way. So my larger hope is that literature changes culture, that this is the way people write and see and understand the nature of the world, and the culture will change. And, you know, originally I looked for a literature that did not lead to extinction and did not lead to climate collapse and did not lead to social and political chaos and violence. And it may have started a really, really long time ago when I had a boyfriend who was an anthropologist, and I was reading his paper, and he said, "I argue." And I said to him, "Why are you saying I argue? Why do you have to have an argument?" He said, "That's how we do it." So I'd like to change that. And not so much I. Let's see if we can find the voice of we, you know, that's the thing about the natural world, is that it's a we voice. It is an interconnected, interrelational voice. And how can we move into that? And maybe, who knows, maybe English itself would be suffused with spiritual values and the values of the natural world.
Well, thank you so much for all that, and thank you for not only the wonderful conversation, but for your wonderful work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dina Metzger. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.